May it please the Court, Joshua Jones on behalf of Appellant Bo Brindley. Your Honor, the parties are in agreement with regard to the procedural error in this case, that the District Court was not proper to proceed under summary procedures of Rule 42B. So unless there are any specific questions regarding that issue, I was planning to address specifically the issue where there is contention, whether or not the Court should reach the substantive issue of sufficiency and reverse the conviction.
Well, I have one question of clarification, really, because this matter begins its life as a question about possible contempt for the failure to show at the pretrial hearing on November 26 of last year. And then, by the time all is said and done, after the show cause hearing on November 30, a second issue enters the case, which is whether Mr. Brindley lied to the court or in any other way misbehaved in terms of the things that were said about a possible conflict with a state court proceeding on November 30. So those look like two different things, and I want to know how they relate to each other and whether the further proceedings under 42A would cover both of those, or how you sort those out.
Well, the district court certainly seemed to, when it did finally issue its order, distinguish between the different contempts, the one being missing, where they issued the order to show cause for missing November 26th, and then the later two alleged contempts were the result of the filings that occurred and then also the conduct of the actual show cause hearing. It's our position that the evidence was insufficient on each of those three and that there should be reversal and no remand for proceedings under 42A on any of the three individual ones, though obviously the analysis would be distinct as to each specific allegation of contempt. I think the evidence is most clear with regard to the November 26th allegation of contempt, as there's simply absolutely no evidence in the record to indicate that the missing the court date was willful, that there was any motive as to why Mr. Brindley would intentionally absent himself from that court date. I think where the issues get a little bit more complicated is when we're talking about what actually occurs on the date. I don't think there's any dispute between the parties that all three contempt citations or three allegations of contempt should not have proceeded under Rule 42B, that there was no the presence requirement was not fulfilled, and that there was no sense of urgency or immediacy where the court needed to address those things by proceeding summarily. So I think the two questions before the court with regard to these contempts are, one, whether or not the court is going to reach the substantive issues or simply remand for proceedings under 42A, and if the court is going to reach them, whether or not the evidence was insufficient as a matter of law.
So it seems to me that the record is indeed extremely thin, that anything leading up to the November 26 failure to appear was anything but extremely sloppy, you know, practice or, you know, negligence or inattention or something like that. I have a hard time finding in the record anything that makes it worse than that. It's actually very difficult to think of a motive to do that. The November 30 events are, it seems to me, contestable. I mean, I don't see how you can avoid the Rule 42A hearing with respect to them.
Well, Your Honor, presuming that the court is analyzing those...
Well, they trouble me more. I'm not making up my mind on the 26th either, but certainly I'm more troubled by the potential implications of the various November 30 problems.
Your Honor, I think while I agree that the issues are a little more complicated with regard to those two counts, that they fail for similar reasons and that there's no evidence of intent or willfulness with regard to the statements.
What if you thought that Mr. Brindley called, is it Mr. Witzak, and said, hey, you know, hurry over and try to get something scheduled on November 30th so that I can avoid this hearing. I don't want to do it now. I mean, none of that, I'm making that all up because we haven't had a proper hearing. But couldn't you see a potential story that would be very troubling about how that business about the state court hearing even came up? If there hadn't been any state court hearing pending until Mr. Brindley tried to create a conflict, supposedly, you know, allegedly,
I agree that if
that would be very dishonest conduct to the federal court. It seems to me potentially punishable by contempt.
Your Honor, if the what the district court seems to have presumed happened here and this they created this conflict, I agree with you that that would be contemptible, or at least could be this
to us.
Contemptuous.
Maybe contemptible also.
But I, based on the evidence that that the district court had collected regarding it, there was no evidence that that's what happened. The only evidence that the district court had before it with regard to that was both Mr. Brinley's statement and Mr. Witsack's statement that what happened was essentially not a lack of communication with regard to what the nature of the proceeding on the 30th was going to be.
But the district court, I mean, not the all troubling, but you know, he made all these phone calls to his friend in the state court and had collected additional information beyond what you're saying.
That's correct, Your Honor, but none of the information that the district court collected contradicted what Mr. Brinley and Mr. Witsack indicated had happened in this case. And the, you know, I think it's important to keep in mind that, you know, the courts have held contempt is a crime in the regular sense. The standard to which the court is supposed to determine that a contempt occurred at the district court level, obviously the standard is different here when you're reviewing sufficiency, but at the district court level, it's beyond a reasonable doubt. And whether or not the district court, looking at having the sworn testimony of Mr. Brinley, the sworn affidavit of Mr. Witsack, that both are consistent saying what happened here, and essentially what the court does is call some of people that it knows, and there's some unknown allegations of previous acts, and based on that is going to conclude beyond a reasonable doubt the opposite of the sworn testimony. I don't think that's evidence that's sufficient to support a finding.
Well, that's why it shouldn't be direct contempt, because he's got to go outside what occurs directly in front of him to get that information. But I don't think that's the same as saying there's insufficient evidence falsity of those representations.
Well, I agree that is the fact that he went outside the record is a good is the reason why it's summary contempt is not appropriate among other reasons. But even going beyond the record, he doesn't have any evidence that conflicts with this account of how it happened. If this were
he doesn't need to prove. I mean, at that point, if you're going to go to the 42A route. He needs to have, in a sense, sort of probable cause to think that there's a problem. Then you have the hearing. You don't have to have proven it first before you have the hearing.
Our allegation is not that there's not enough here that in the first instance somebody could proceed under 42A. Our allegation here is because the district court chose to proceed under 42B and did not produce evidence that was sufficient to support a finding of guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, that it would be double jeopardy to allow the district court to reinstitute these proceedings.
It's not double jeopardy, though, if Mr. Brindley's the one who took the appeal. It's like any criminal defendant who takes an appeal, asks for a new proceeding, and then that's not double jeopardy.
No, Your Honor, the Supreme Court has held in Lockhart, for instance, that where the evidence is insufficient as a matter of law, double jeopardy does operate on an appeal even when the defendant takes that appeal.
Well, okay, that's a different situation. Well, anyway, if you'd like to save a little rebuttal time, this would be the time.
I will. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Meisler?
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Scott Meisler from the Department of Justice on behalf of the United States. On the last point, the double jeopardy point, this Court has a prudential rule that it generally reviews the sufficiency of the evidence, and that was announced in the case called United States versus Douglas in 1989. But Douglas also holds that there's no double jeopardy problem in the exact procedural posture we have here where a case is reversed for trial error. Basically, there's no double jeopardy right to have an appellate court reach the sufficiency of the evidence at the same time that it reverses for trial error. So there's actually no double jeopardy problem here. And I think the Court concluded the same thing in Trudeau when it cited to Lockhart versus Nelson in remanding that case. In our view, Your Honor, Trudeau, Trout, and Moschiano from this Court are three cases that make clear that the District Court committed an error in resorting to summary contempt, but there are also cases that make clear that the proper remedy is to remand for further proceedings under 42A.
And Judge, what conceivable evidence is there that contempt proceedings ought to go forward on the November 26th failure to appear?
Well, I was going to try to address that now, Your Honor. You asked at the beginning, what is the relationship among the allegedly false statements, the statements the district court found to be false, and the failure to appear. And I guess my position, Your Honor, would be that the false statements could be, of course, potentially independent grounds for contempt, whether under Section 401.1 or Section 401.3, we'd have to determine. But I think certainly they could also be evidence of consciousness of guilt in terms of the willfulness component of a 401.3 charge as far as failure to appear. I think courts and fact finders often infer willfulness from a party's conduct, not just at the moment, but from things the party did before and after the action in question. So if we're looking into mens rea evidence, I would think that if a party was trying to cover up actions and did so through false statements to put off the proceedings, a fact finder could consider that as evidence. I'm not sure it would be enough evidence by itself to prove contempt beyond a reasonable doubt, but again, we don't have any kind of record here, and that's really the problem, is that we have a summary proceeding where no prosecutor was appointed, as a prosecutor must be appointed under 42A, to flesh out, to try to subpoena records, look into anything. There's probably not going to be a smoking gun. I'm not sure we're going to find a ledger or a date book in Mr. Brindley's office that says, I don't like this judge, I'm not going to show up to his hearing. But in theory, there could be something that comes up that would be, you know, that would be evidence combined with false statements. If those are borne out, that would show, that would be enough to show willfulness. Because I think there's no dispute that there was a reasonably specific order of the court and that it was disobeyed. So all we're talking about on the failure to appear is just the willfulness component.
Right. Yeah,
and that's the kind of thing that I think is really tailor-made for a fact finder, a bench trial, or a jury trial to determine based on a fuller record. And so, again, I don't really have all that much to add except that we think those three cases are the ones that can control here. If the court has any further questions about what would happen on remand, I'd be happy to try to address those, but I think it would be uncertain because we do have here a new judge that would be presiding on remand, independent of Circuit Rule 36. So someone's going to take a fresh look at this. If it goes forward under 42A in whole or in part, then, of course, a prosecutor would be appointed and the proceedings could go forward from there.
The fresh judge has to make an initial determination of whether to refer it for prosecution.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. And in this case, depending on how the court writes its opinion and what the suggestions are from this court, again, there may be some issue about what the notice, the Rule 42A notice, would look like, whether, given what happened after the initial notice in this case, there were allegations of false statements, whether those would be part of further proceedings, maybe that would be spelled out in the notice or not. Again, I'm not really certain how that would play out, but certainly that could be addressed on remand.
And regardless of the reference by the judge,
I'm sorry, Anna, I'm missing the question.
Even if the judge refers it for prosecution, it's not required that it be prosecuted. Is that right?
Right. There is discretion. The rule does say that it goes to the U.S. Attorney's office first, and if the U.S. Attorney declines, then the judge would have the opportunity to appoint an independent prosecutor. I should mention in all candor in this case, perhaps because of the role the AUSA played in this case, there may be a recusal from the Central District, may be referred to a different office to pursue. But I'm not sure. That also has to be determined probably on further proceedings.
All right. Thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Jones?
Just very briefly, I just would point out that in Seal, this court, and in Gates, the Fourth Circuit did reach the sufficiency issue, and they looked at the record that actually existed. They did not consider what might turn up later. And I think those cases are the ones that are more on point than Trudeau because of the nature of how this proceeding went down.
All right. Thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.